My name's Andy Gordon. I'm originally from the UK, the West Country, and now I'm living in New Zealand for the past almost 10 years, I guess. Before that, I was living in Canada and Hong Kong and many other places.
Now, New Zealand is a couple of years ago, actually a year or so ago, decided it's had enough of Jacinda and gone over to a more nationalist government. What's been the sort of general change for those living in New Zealand like you?
Yeah, well, they're kind of a right-wing government now, and they're up to the old tricks of basically trying to run everything into the ground and privatize it. It's the old it's that old playbook, So they've been making massive cuts pretty much in every government department, and they're trying to make out that everything's broken and it might be a good idea to sell some of the government assets off, like the trains and ferries and so on.
This is a bit ironic, isn't it? Because the right is supposedly nationalist, and what they're doing, both, I mean, you're all over the world, really, is they're what they're doing is they're handing these national assets over to transnational corporations, often to, say, for example, China. So it doesn't really make sense. They're not actually nationalists at all.
Yeah, well, they're selling these things off. They want to sell it to themselves, basically, to their mates, So I think that's how it's going. I mean, New Zealand has got a law which does stop the Chinese buying state assets and even large companies, So New Zealand is quite good on that respect, but obviously they can sell it to their rich American friends or their rich friends in New Zealand, So that's their kind of playbook.
Yeah, anyway, you pinged me this week to say that there's been some changes. It's great to have you there in Dunedin looking at, what's going on in that part of the world, because it's right on the other side. You need a pretty powerful mirror to be able to see what's going on over there. In the Pacific Islands. So maybe it would be a good idea to start by just saying why the Pacific Islands are important and which ones are going through some political changes.
Yeah, so there's been quite a few geopolitical moves in the Pacific on these islands by China. And a few years ago, they signed an agreement with Kiribati Islands. And, since that time, America and New Zealand and Australia have all started to get really worried about this. And they've been piling money into the other islands to try and stop them signing with China. And obviously they're using these moves by China as an excuse to expand their own military presence, on the islands and in the Pacific in general, And since Kiribati has signed this agreement with China, there's been the Solomon Islands, which have also signed up to an agreement with China. And these agreements include defense of the islands if there's trouble, So there is a military aspect to it. But in some respects, I think that military aspect to it, they've kind of just copied the old agreement which they had with New Zealand, let's say, or Australia or the US. Yeah, there's some very interesting moves being made. And just this week, there's talk of the Cook Islands going over to sign an agreement with China. And obviously, that's got the Kiwis' backs right up because, the Cook Islands is basically New Zealand. They don't have their own passport. They use New Zealand passports. They've got a right to New Zealand passports, and they've got a right to come to New Zealand anytime they feel free, So there's a massive debate going on now between New Zealand and the Cook Islands that, New Zealand's basically threatening that they're going to take away their passports, Kiwi passports, and the rights to come here. So it's quite concerning from New Zealand's point of view, this one, although apparently the Cook Islands are not going to sign any military agreement with China. So the Cook Islanders are trying to have it both ways in some ways. They want to introduce their own passport and still have the right to a New Zealand passport, and they also want New Zealand to defend them, you know, even though they're signing this agreement with China. So yeah, it's an interesting situation.
No, it really is. And just from a sort of geographical point of view, trying to understand what the map looks like, you know, obviously you've got Australia and New Zealand to the north and northeast in the Pacific there. You've got a whole load of different island groups from sort of working your way across from the west to the east. You've got the Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, New Caledonia, which are... I'm not sure who controls the Solomon Islands, but that's French, New Caledonia. Plus, you've got then Fiji, which is independent. Plus, you've got more French islands, the Wallis and the Futuna Islands. You've got Samoa, American Samoa, Tonga, and the Cook Islands. It says on the map of New Zealand anyway. And then French Polynesia. Above that, to the north, you've got the Marshall Islands, the Mariana Islands. But there's a hell of a lot out there. And it just seems to me amazing that the New Zealanders and the West generally seem to be prepared for the Chinese to come along, do investment deals, and they're not actually trying to compete with them. In fact, what they'd rather than trying to, should we say, use the carrot, in other words, investment, to encourage the locals to stay loyal to the West, they seem to be trying to use the stick, sort of saying, well, if you do this deal with the Chinese, we're going to punish you.
Yeah, well, there is that. But I mean, they have been trying to kind of bribe them back, because, I mean, even with Kiribati in the last 3 years, you know, they've been putting massive amounts of money into them. Still, you know, just last year, New Zealand sent aid to Kiribati of $33 million. You know, Australia did a similar amount, and America was not far behind. And you know, that's just unbelievable amount of money when you consider the population of Kiribati. The whole island nation is only 130 odd thousand people, you know, so it's absolutely tiny. It's only, you know, an eighth or a quarter the size of sort of Bristol, I imagine, you know. So they are trying to bring them back into the fold, you know. So and just on Kiribati, I mean, I sent you an article not too long ago about China sending a missile from China into Kiribati waters. And just like you said, the positioning of it's interesting, because, I mean, they are, you know, halfway between New Zealand and Hawaii there, and the Marshall Islands are between them and China. So the missile must have virtually gone over the Marshall Islands, which is obviously an American territory. And it is American territory where they supposedly keep the nuclear weapons in the Pacific, you know. So it's very interesting. And the missile they sent was actually a nuclear capable missile that China sent over the top of them. So yeah, they must have been sweating inside the military base in the Marshall Islands, I imagine, when they sent that missile unexpectedly over the top of them.
So who do you think's reacting to who? Are the Americans reacting by trying to love bomb the islands with money to the Chinese approaches, or is it the other way around?
Well, I think, to be honest, is you know, the Chinese, they're very interested in economic expansion, aren't they? And I don't think there's anything malicious particularly about it. It's you know, they're after, with Kiribati, the fishing rights. With the Cook Islands, they're after the deep sea mining rights, apparently. So it's about money, as most things are. But I think it's the Americans who are really trying to sort of, you know, get a bigger military presence in the region, using this expansion of Chinese economic growth as a kind of excuse, you know. And there are obviously parties, groups of people in the US who would love to get a war started in the Pacific. I'm sure, you know, you've got America building these nuclear submarines, you know, costing billions of dollars, and it's all designed to get something going in the Pacific, you know. So I think China are fairly innocent in the whole situation. They're interested in expansion, you know, in economic terms more than military terms, I'd say. But obviously America would love to take China down a peg or two, wouldn't they, in their economic expansion. So Yeah, that's my theory of what's going on. And I've just been looking at a guy who's kind of stirring this all up, a guy called Peter Zeihan. And he's got a book out called The End of the World is Just the Beginning. You know, and this is the guy who's advising the New Zealand government on Pacific matters. He's also advising the US on Pacific matters. And he's got, you know, very good contacts in Washington. And he's making hundreds of thousands of dollars per year advising these governments. And I'm sure he's also advising some of these Pacific islands as well, you know, because he is a so-called expert on this. And he's very anti-China. You know, he believes that China will collapse, you know, within 30 seconds, kind of. And he's been saying this for 10 years. And if you go online, there are plenty of people debunking his statistics about China. You know, China is not going to collapse suddenly like he predicts, you know, and he's the one who is trying to shift New Zealand away from China, because obviously New Zealand's biggest trading partner is China. Everything New Zealand can produce, you know, milk, beef, sheep, everything they can produce, China will buy it. But he's telling them you need to diversify. He's trying to shift them to send their milk and stuff to India, you know, because he's telling them that, oh, China's just going to collapse and you're going to be screwed, you know. So or he's telling them there's a coming war with China, you know, so you need to get away from China, you know. So at the moment, New Zealand, they want to be friends with China because they make a lot of money from China. But as soon as they move away from China and start selling to other countries, you know, they'll be like Australia. They'll be gunning for a kind of war, you know, I think, with China.
Well, this is one of the ways you prevent wars happening is by having good, strong trade links and becoming economically interdependent. That's quite a good way to stop people fighting. And when
exactly
these massive trade barriers go up, I mean, just looking at the geopolitics of all of this, the United States is not able to manufacture anywhere near the quality and quantity of goods, let alone do the research and development that they can in China, because they've got such low labor costs, because they've got very low housing costs, they've got very low energy costs, they've got low transport costs. They've managed to keep all these costs, as it may be like in 1950s and 1960s Britain, very, very low. And so they're taking over economically, and so they've beaten the Americans at this industrial game. And it's like, well, the Americans don't want to admit they're beaten, so they're going to use other methods to try to box China in and prohibit them from having the industrial success that they deserve for being actually better than the Americans at this game.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right, Tony. And you know, I think Trump's very clever, really, with his tariffs, because you know, that will make an American manufacturer more competitive against China. He can, if there's a big tariff on China, he can now compete with China. And this is the sort of approach that the UK should have taken when Brexit happened. You know, rather than going trying to get all these free trade agreements all around the world, they should have employed a similar policy, because, you know, that would have fired up the factories in Birmingham again, you know, and so on. And I can see with Trump, he's gonna get, you know, these manufacturing hubs like Detroit and stuff. If he brings in these tariffs, you know, the companies will start opening again, because they will be able to compete again with Mexico or China or whoever it is, you know. And I think even with his tariffs he's introducing on places like Canada and Europe, you know, there will be manufacturers in Germany, in Canada, who will just say, well, let's shift to America, you know, because we don't want to pay the tariffs. So I think it's quite a clever policy from Trump, you know, in that respect. And maybe he will bring a bit of economic success back to America and away from China and these other places.
So Elon Musk and Trump are obviously very close. Trump is not stupid. In the old days, it was Rupert Murdoch, and of course, he's got him on side with Fox News. Nowadays, it's Twitter that helps to win elections. They can use the algorithms in order to, I think it was Robert Epstein, the professor not sure which university in the States he was at, that did a study showing that the algorithms in the Google search can tip an election 30% one way or another way, just simply by which stories pop up when you put a candidate's name in. You know, you can either, you put one candidate in and you get a whole load of terrible negative stories, or another candidate and you get loads of positive stories. So this can skew public opinion massively in the run-up to an election. But Musk is obviously able to do a similar thing with Twitter. So I wonder who's in charge, do you think? Trump or Musk? Has Musk sort of decided he's going to use Trump in order to get his way? Or is it the other way around?
Yeah, well, I think that these Silicon Valley crowds, you know, Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and so on, you know, the role I see them in is they're kind of Trump's, you know, kind of soothsayers, you know, because they are into the dark arts and so on. You know, they're into this E-Act, you know, effective accelerationism and so on. And I think they're advising Trump in a way. And so they are, you know, they are in charge in a way, because, you know, he is listening to them and he thinks that they're wonderful, kind of, you know. So Trump's moved away from listening to the old crowd, maybe, you know, the CIA and deep state people, and he's moved on to these soothsayers of the Silicon Valley, you know. So that's how I see their role.
Well, this E-Act sounds interesting. That's something I've not heard of before. What does it stand for again?
It stands for effective accelerationism. You know, so they are accelerationists, a bit like that Peter Zeihan. You know, I see him as a kind of accelerationist in the Pacific here. But yeah, this E-Act is kind of a development from Nick Land's work, you know, your friend Nick Land there. And according to information I've seen on Nick Land, he loves the idea of this EAC accelerationism, because it's, you know, they kind of worship him in some of these quarters. They see him as the god of this accelerationism. And, you know, EAC is a kind of, it's a kind of twist on the dark accelerationism which Nick Land was into. And it's more kind of this utopian version. They kind of believe that they should suck out more energy from nature, and they're deluded, because as of yet there's no technology to really capture this energy.
Well, that sounds maybe using more fossil fuels or something. I mean, look, we've got to say something about Nick here, because, I mean, this idea of worship, you know, worshipping Nick, I know what you mean, because there seem to be a lot of people that think the sun shines out of his backside, basically, that he's really got it right in some way. But he's definitely, I mean, he certainly is the father of accelerationism, which is one of the main things driving, it seems, the philosophies driving many of the elites out there. So it's bizarre to have this as a sort of teenage schoolmate being behind this. He's now in Shanghai, which is the sort of new Manchester in a way. When that was the Industrial Revolution, it's Shanghai is the powerhouse of industrial China and financial China. So he obviously knows which side his bread is buttered. But with Nick, the other thing he's quite well known for is this whole thing called the Dark Enlightenment. Now, this to me is particularly actually scary and spooky, because the original Enlightenment was in the late 1700s, early 1800s was a Masonic for a start. It was started by the Freemasons, which was necessarily no bad thing, because Freemasonry in those times in Britain was supposedly Christian, but it was. The idea was, well, we've got all these kind of puritanical, annoying preachers everywhere who tell us what we can and can't think. Let's join the Freemasons and we can say what we really think. And through the Freemasons, there were all sorts of scientific innovations, like things like the steam engine. John Robison, he was the inventor of the siren. So this was a kind of mechanical thing that made a screaming sound, and he wrote an expose of the Illuminati. But I mean, they were all into this Enlightenment. The idea is to bring this amazing, you know, sort of technology and innovation to Britain, not really to the world, because they wanted to use it to you know, sort of further the aims of the empire. But the modern version of this dark Enlightenment is something I think more sinister. It's not, even though for many people living in the 1800s, the original Enlightenment actually meant that they were kicked off of their land, kicked off the fields, and the you know, these kind of reaping and threshing machines took over from the agricultural workers, and they were left unemployed, and they had to go and work in factories and this sort of thing. But nowadays, this dark Enlightenment of Nick's is it's almost as if everything is focused around computers and AI, and humanity is going to, rather than be sort of subservient to Nick worshipping him, it's going to be subservient to some sort of an AI in the future. So anyway, I wonder if, you know, how that fits in with what the effective accelerationists are up to.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is, I think some of these, you know, accelerationists, these effective accelerationists, you know, they were trying to turn Nick's ideas of the dark Enlightenment, you know, kind of to a good perspective. But then I think that, you know, there's so many of these groups popping up in Silicon Valley, and it's become very fashionable to read Nick's book and other, you know, philosophers from France and so on that Nick was into. So they kind of do their homework, and then they come up with their own version. And it's been picked up right by the top boys, you know, like Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, and Mark Andreessen's one of them. You know, he's a billionaire behind a lot of these Silicon Valley companies, and he's written his own EAC manifesto, you know. So and I think those people, the ones you really need to watch, these billionaires, they are kind of turning it back to a darker sort of version of accelerationism. You know, so I mean, and they see Nick as a kind of god. And I don't know, what do you think? I mean, you knew him when he was young. What was he like when he was young? Is he some kind of god or well, some genius, or what is he?
Okay, well, this it's important, I think, people understand. We were at Langley Park, which was a grammar school before the comprehensives started up, under Shirley Williams in the 1970s. She got rid of most of the grammar schools. So the first thing to say about Nick really is that his nickname was Nick the Nazi, or Nazi Nick. And this is 1975-6, I think I first got to know him, age 14. And the interesting thing about Nick was that he knew more than any of the masters in the school. He was incredibly knowledgeable on, particularly on war history, on things like physics and technology and the sorts of possibilities. I remember him talking in our first physics lessons about faster than light travel and all the difficulties with that. I mean, he wasn't just, maybe he was well read. He was also very interested in things like authors like William Gibson, who I borrowed some William Gibson off of him reading this at school and found it fascinating, really interesting. Of course, this is all very futuristic and looking at battles going on in sort of cyber warfare, that sort of thing into the future. This is, remember, the 1970s. This is a long, long way ahead. I also remember him talking about the internet and the fact that the internet was coming along. Now, this is, if you think about it, this is 20 years before the internet really arrived. So he obviously was way ahead of the game. He talked a lot about psychology and, you know, the sort of deep basics of psychology. So I was getting from Nick, you know, in the breaks and at around his house on a Saturday, I was getting a fantastically rounded education, filling in loads of the gaps that the Langley Park masters were never going to teach me. So, I mean, I wasn't interested or attracted to his Nazi-ness, and he was a Nazi. He was very pro-Hitler. I was just fascinated and very attracted to his immense knowledge that he seemed to have, and I've no idea really where it came from. I mean, we would go around there on a Saturday to his house on Warren Road, which was just off just on the edge of Hayes Common in Kent, a big, lovely big common, right on the, basically on like a sort of stockbroker belt edge of London. And he would, on a Saturday sometimes, we would all go over, and rather than play war games, which is what we would normally do at lunchtime or sort of 12 o'clock, 11 o'clock on a Saturday, through the afternoon with his mum bringing us cups of tea. And his dad, who was a director of Shell South Africa, occasionally wafting through. We would be playing these tabletop SPI games, Avalon Hill games, Diplomacy Club, he basically called it. And there were three or four of us that used to go around there quite regularly, including a chap called Rob Smith I'm still in touch with. So sometimes if the weather was good, Nick would lead us on a sort of mission, as a kind of army unit, out onto Hayes Common, where we would be doing all sorts of training, almost like a sort of terrorist training thing. Now, I mean, as 14-year-olds, this was great fun. We loved it. At the same time, Nick and I were both in the local 578 squadron at the school of the air training corps. So we used to play war games there as well sometimes. They would set up war games too. So that was basically it, really. And he was a character, it seemed to me, who was absolutely driven and incredibly knowledgeable. But, you know, it was a dark sense of humour he had, and he seemed to delight in things like the atrocities of the Vietnam War, the despoilation of the farmland that came through things like Agent Orange. And I always remember him saying he wanted to start a band, because that's what people did in the 70s. His band was going to be called Nicky Putrid and the Atomic Vomits. And so anyway, Nick, that was the sort of character he was. Dark sense of humour, very driven, extremely intelligent, and actually very privileged with his, you know, wealthy dad's background as a director of Shell in South Africa. Now, if you think about South Africa in Shell in the 1980s and 70s, this was a very controversial thing. This was in the days of mega apartheid, and it's almost like Cecil Rhodes's shadow was still cast over South Africa and Rhodesia and all these areas, and there was a horrific apartheid still going on there. But this didn't really bother Nick. And the interesting thing was, though, when we got to the sixth form, which was co-educational, we'd been at a boys' school together at Langley Park in this grammar school in near West Wickham in Kent. And next door, by the way, was the headquarters of Burroughs Welcome. So we used to look through the fence, and you would see, what would you see? You would see cows. And we used to joke, this is cows with two heads here, because the Welcome Trust was doing some of the cutting edge genetic engineering experiments in the 1970s. So goodness knows what they were doing to the animals that were in the fields opposite or just through the fence from us. But it was not just the Welcome Trust, it was Burroughs Welcome. So Burroughs computers were there. Now, if you go to Victor Ostrovsky's book, By Way of Deception, he's a former Mossad agent and one of the great, super great Mossad whistleblowers. Brilliant book, is fantastically well written and very fast paced. You read it in about 2 days. You're almost unputdownable. He talks about Burroughs computers in the 70s and 80s, developing the first ever systems to have maps on the wall of the Mossad directors, whoever the chiefs were, so they could watch all of the members of the Palestine Liberation Organization, Yasser Arafat and his mates, and have each of them as a dot on the map. And as they moved, as they got in a car or a train or on a plane, the dots would all move around on their map. So that's what Burroughs were up to, and they were right next door to our school. So I'm not sure if Nick had any connection with what was going on in there, anyway, that's the sort of person he was. And it's interesting that he's become influential today.
That's right. What do you think about Nick now, though? I mean, do you think he's linked to British intelligence or what he's up to now? What do you actually think of what he's doing now?
Look, I don't think it's really got much at all to do with Britain anymore. It seems to me that it's an international move, which is decided for some reason that the industrial center of planet Earth is not going to be Europe, Britain, America or anything like that anymore. It's going to be China. So the powerhouse will be China. Now, China is, you know, avowedly atheist. It's also controlled by President Xi, who is like a kind of pope. So there's quite this kind of religious atheism really going on over there. You're not allowed to laugh during the national anthem, for example, which must be very difficult for some, maybe for the Hong Kongers. And but it's, I mean, it's just a religious sort of cult, basically, China it's become. Xi himself is a robot, basically, a sort of Biden-style person. I don't know if you've seen, there's a fantastic clip of one of his aides being like rugby tackled as he's trying to get through a door. He's walking along just behind Xi, and he's one of Xi's presidential aides, and somebody has decided, oh no, it's an intruder, we've got to stop them getting in. And he sort of realizes this guy's been nobbled, but he pretends he hasn't noticed. I mean, he's a sort of zombie, really, and he's going to read out speech. Noticed,
but
yeah,
I was in Hong Kong recently, and you know, I haven't been there for probably 10 years, and it was amazing to see the difference, you know, in the museums, in the art galleries. All of the Hong Kong culture and history has been wiped away, and it's been replaced with mainland China history and art, you know. So before, when I was there, they had great historical things about China, and the museum was fascinating, but now it's just completely gone over to this communist you know, history, basically. And the same with the art gallery, there's not one Hong Kong artist in there, they're all mainland Chinese artists, you know. So it is interesting to see that. And I mean, from what I understand of Hong Kong, there is a massive amount, you know, you're saying that they don't like this national anthem and thing, but a lot of them have actually left, you know, to places like the UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, you know, especially UK. I heard that there's a massive amount of number of Hong Kong people moved there now. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, so it's an interesting place for Nick to have sort of planted himself, because I think he sees this as the future, which is this kind of massive atheistic world controlled by China. Now, you know, you look at what's going on in the rest of the world, you can see the Russians are sort of spoiling. Well, no, the Russians aren't spoiling for the fight, but the US most definitely, and Europe, Britain particularly, seems to be spoiling for a fight with the Russians. Now, if that happens, which it may do, it may not do, but I mean, you can see why the Chinese might be just sitting there biding their time. Well, let's wait for these two lot to beat each other up, and once they're both knocked out on the floor, we'll clear up. That seems to be the game. The Chinese, although they're doing deals with the Russians, apparently, you know, to sort of support them in Ukraine, maybe they'll do something in the Middle East. I don't know. China just seems to be waiting for the rest of the world to destroy itself economically, militarily, whatever, socially.
That's right. I mean, China, I don't think they're going to, they are not the type of country to make any aggressive moves, you know. So literally they have a military for defense, you know the Americans will be very lucky to provoke them into any kind of war, I'd say. You know, I think they, you know, they are not stupid, you know. So
looking at their politics, I mean, they could turn on a sixpence, you know. This could all change. I can always remember I think I would be probably about 30, my late 20s, commuting up to London. And on the trains, I used to hop on the train at, I think it was Grove Park or somewhere like that. And you would get the fast trains come through. Ours would be the last stop. So I would always get in the first class carriage, because you knew you weren't going to get your ticket checked on the way up to Victoria or Charing Cross or whatever. And I remember sitting in there one day with some guys from the Foreign Office, and we were just going into work. And chit-chatting with them about some war that was going on. I don't know what it would be. Maybe it was the first Gulf War or something. And I said to them, yeah, but what about China? And they looked at each other and they said, well, we haven't got a fucking clue what to do about China. And I thought, this is an interesting reaction. They really were completely flummoxed. And that, I mean, I don't know, you know, quite what part of the Foreign Office they were from. And I suppose they didn't know me from Adam. But I don't think that there is anything that I mean, another thing, important thing to say about the Chinese, of course, is Chairman Mao was given his start by Yale University. His because of course he was right way from the time of the First World War right the way through to before the Second World War, and it all started kicking off there with the Chinese Civil War. He was being funded by Yale University to with a network of bookshops to foster this these Marxist ideas, and particularly to get the Chinese Communist Party going. This was money from Yale University, from, you know, maybe something associated with the Skull and Bone Society. But I didn't realize that Mao was so absolutely tied in with all this. And of course, it was a particularly bloody conflict. It's something that we're not really told about. You know, we hear a lot about the Russian Revolution and the overthrow of the Tsars, but not so much about Chairman Mao. And of course, when that conflict finished after the Second World War, the remains of the nationalist Chinese all ended up in Taiwan, which now is a massive kind of focal point. But so we've done a bit of a tour around. I think if people are interested in looking into this EACT thing, I mean, they have no affinity for biological humans, they say, you know, this sort of
thing. Yeah, well, and I was going to say, I mean, if you want to look into this EACT, the best tip I can give you is to what they do is they abbreviate it to E/AACC, both in capitals as well. And, you know, we're dealing with tech savvy people, so they don't want everybody to know. But if you put that into the search engines, there'll be more stuff than you could ever read in a lifetime, you know.
Yeah, and I think what I might do is put a link up to quite a good Business Insider article from a year or so ago saying the headline is "The Effective Accelerationism Movement Doesn't Care If Humans Are Replaced by AI, So Long As They're There to Make Money From It." So they do want humans to survive somehow as a sort of profit center, which is a pretty cynical way of looking at all this, annoying people that they are. Shall we finish by talking a bit about AI? Because, I mean, I've been noticing recently by playing some bits and pieces on the program where you just feed in a PDF of a book to the AI and it digests it, probably delivers it up to the great brain in Silicon Valley somewhere, and uses that to learn about how people think. And then it delivers a sort of between 7 and 15 minute audio interview between two AI bots saying, this is a summary of what you've just given us, which is quite handy. If you wanted to read a book, you think this is a good idea. But the thing I noticed is there's lots and lots missing. So they don't tease out any of the key specific passages, points that are being made by the writers. And also there's no sense of irony or conspiracy. David Livingstone pointed this out the other week. You know, you've got them talking about something, but they're not understanding or realizing or expressing this idea that there is a hidden agenda anywhere. It's all very literal. So anyway, what do you make of AI, the future, and, you know, how we should be taking it on?
Yeah, well, I think we are, you know, we're one step away from having, you know, radio hosts and content creators who are just computers, you know, they're just AIs, you know. But I'm not a great believer in it, or even though it's improving every day, you know, they're just improving old tricks, really, and rebranding it as AI. You know, we've always had search engines and so on, but now they call them, you know, AI bots and so on, you know. But obviously, it is good to be aware, because like what you're doing, telling people, you know, this is how it works, this is what it sounds like, is very valuable, because soon, if you're not aware, you will be listening to podcasts and so on, and you won't realize that it is a robot. And like you say, they are leaving out crucial bits of information. You know, you can put in the parameters and it will churn out kind of what you want. So the people who design these things, you know, they want a certain worldview, and that's what the computer's going to produce for you. You know, so people like yourself can say something which a computer can probably never say. you know, because well, it could say it possibly if you put the right parameters in. But that's the whole thing. The people designing it, they design it in a certain way, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, so I've been doing this for what, God, since 1990, roughly. What's that, like 35 years or so? And one of the things I've seen during that time is a slow sucking out of the soul of mainstream press, particularly. But I mean, I'm just thinking about the radio station I worked on at Greater London Radio, Marylebone and High Street. This was a station with soul. You know, it was. We not only That's just right. soul music, but we had presenters who had a sense of humour. They had a sense of purpose. They had a sense of, we are here because we care about the listeners, and we want the listeners to trust us because they can trust us, and we're looking out for them. So there are all sorts of forces out there, whether they be financial, technological, or whatever. And we're going to, I mean, a lot of them, of course, are to do with politics, you know, influences, special interest groups influencing politics. That was our job. You know, it was to make sure the public were aware of these things. Now, what I've seen over the last 30 years is a slow denuding of all that. You know, I would say, imagine a Question Time with never any Peter Hitchens. Now, some people might like that. But I mean, someone who's prepared to say the unsayable, burst the bubble, crack a few jokes. What you're ending up with in all over the mainstream media is just the same mush. So you've got a panel of people who basically all agree on the really important stuff and disagree on the unimportant stuff. And so they have a row about that instead. So it seems to me this is all deliberate, actually.
Yeah, well, Andy? That's what the way it could go, Tony. I mean, at the moment, you know, they get these panels on Question Time and so on, and they pick the people they want to pick. But in the future, you could see panels of literally AIs, you know, and they could all be programmed in a slightly different
way. Well, I'm trying to say, but I think most of the people that they've got on are pretty much not much different from an AI anyway. They're people who are in their career. They're interested in saying the right thing. They know what they're supposed to say, and they say it. So what we've done is we've created a mainstream press where the AIs can replace what's going on without hardly anyone noticing. Now, that could not happen 35 years ago. You'd be saying this is rubbish and switch it off, and you'd listen to something else. But now there isn't anywhere else to listen to, because voices like RT, Press TV, etc., have all been banned in Britain.
That's right. So it's lucky I live in New Zealand where they haven't. but yeah, you're dead right that that's the way it's going. And, you know, whole newsrooms and all the rest of it will be replaced with these robots. And like I told you the other day, is, you know, there's been a case in America of somebody created one of these bots, and, you know, it's a visual thing as well. It was on Instagram. And obviously it's a pretty girl and all the rest of it. And it's so lifelike that people do not realize that she's fake. And she got, you know, millions of followers. And it took a couple of years before the word got out that this person on Instagram was actually fake, you know, an AI. So this is the world we're sort of moving into. And, you know, I'm sure the governments of the world are light years ahead with this already, you know, and we don't realize, like you were saying. I'm sure a lot of you know, content created for politicians is all AI generated now, you know, because they want to try and please as many people as possible with their speeches and so on. So it is interesting.
It's horrible. But look, I mean, this is a military technology. Let's just, you know, call it like it is. The idea here is a military technology, also used for things like voice simulation. So you can have your wife call you up, but actually it's AI, and tell you to do something, and you do it because you think it's your wife. I mean, this is the sort of way that you can arrange and trick someone into an assassination, or else maybe you can get the president to say something that you've recorded that you can then broadcast around the world. They wouldn't have said if you hadn't tricked them into saying it. So there's all sorts of military applications for this sort of thing.
Well, Tony, we know that even 25 years ago, when there was speeches allegedly from a what's his name? Osama bin Laden. Some of those videos were faked, with imposing his voice, and he didn't really say those things at all, so I mean they had that 20 odd years ago, so this is, you can just imagine what they can do now, can't you? And yeah,
I think it's a good idea to definitely have a look at people like this AI model that people were following on Instagram. I mean, this is quite important that people get, because the sense to me is that they're trying to, the elite institutions are those that control the press, particularly in social media, the tech giants, the Musks of this world, are trying to smuggle this technology in surreptitiously, so that it just becomes like the idea of certainly not flagging it up. So if a journalistic article is written by an AI, that they're giving the journalist a false name. If a speech that a politician reads out is written by AI, there's no way of knowing whether it is AI. So they're trying to bring this in under the radar, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. And one last thing I was going to say on the accelerationism, like I was saying, there's a lot of different branches out there. And one interesting one that's sort of popped up, which is getting more popular, is DACT. So D/ACC. And it's decentralized accelerationism. So that's another one for your viewers to look into, which is, they believe in nuclear power. They want to fly off to different planets and all sorts of strange stuff. So, there's all these interesting groups down there in Silicon Valley for people to look into. But and obviously it's all run by AI. That's their dream of, they don't want to do much, but the capital is going to work for them, and it's going to, they think this accelerationism is going to be like a virus and sort of bring back money for them with them living on Mars. This is how crazy it is. So yes, it's very interesting stuff.
It is Andy, and thank you ever so much for bringing it up, and thanks very much for doing your report, particularly on what's been going on in the Pacific. The thing to do if people are interested in this is to keep up with the EACT, I suppose, and I'll put a link up on our show page to this artificial intelligence article on Business Insider, which seemed pretty good to me. How do people find you, follow you, etc., over there in Dunedin in New Zealand?
Well, they probably have to tune in to you, Tony, because I'm just reporting for you at the moment. That's about it. I'm not really doing social media or anything.
Okay.
But just one YouTube channel I can recommend is it's mainly about economical things, but it's very good. It's called Maneco 64, which is Maneco 64. And there's some great stuff on there about Nazi gold that was stolen by the Bank of England and all sorts. And he goes through, the Bank of International Settlement records, and there's some good stuff on China as well and Russia. So yeah, I really recommend that one.
I mean, it annoys me because we're getting the mainstream press constantly criticizing social media. The reason everyone's on social media is because they're rubbish. So they're just gaslighting us, all the time. And you won't get any of this discussed properly. You will get it discussed, but it will just be between a bunch of people who agree with each other and they're wrong. So that article from Business Insider again is "The Effective Accelerationism Movement Doesn't Care If Humans Are Replaced by AI, As Long as They're There to Make Money from It." The author is Catherine Tangalekis-Lippert and also Hannah Getterhun, whoever they are, but that's on Business. It's nice to see someone actually doing some decent work on this. And Andy Gordon in New Zealand, thanks very much for joining us again.
You're welcome.